Good morning. Welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM in Toronto. Excuse my slight cold. We've got a number of items to be talking about today. The big FIFA match, the World Cup, etc. We're going to talk about that. Later in the show, we'll be talking, I want to make a report on what is called the International Criminal Court and the problems of that. And to just give you a reminder that one of the great legal minds of the United States, the man who was Attorney General during the struggle for civil rights, for the establishment of the Voter Rights Act, and Ramsey Clark, who, because of his principles, found himself outside the beltway, as I say, because his conscience caused him to say things in the inner circles that were not so welcome. But he made a very powerful argument long ago that this business of United Nations ad hoc justice work, starting with the tribunals for former Yugoslavia. Remember there was a Yugoslavia and it was bombed by Bill Clinton? Do you remember that? There was a country called Yugoslavia and Clinton bombed it and Madeleine Albright celebrated it and Louise Arbour thought it was wonderful and she said she was representing United Nations search for justice. That because, according to her investigators, what do you know, a prosecutor, found that they shouldn't be talking, having peace negotiations with a man named Milosevic, because she was accusing him of a crime. Therefore, they shouldn't have peace talks. And anyone with a political acumen noticed that this seemed to serve the interests of Bill Clinton and his group. It was Clinton. So they went from ad hoc tribunals to something called the International Court, Criminal Court. And it's been a fiasco, but Ramsey Clark said he said that when the United Nations was formed, they didn't attempt to set up a criminal court. They set up a International Court of Justice, which is there, and that its function was to arbitrate, hear cases brought by one state against another. Otherwise, the issue of justice, criminal justice, came under national state sovereignty. But some bird brains in the West who thought they would help imperialism said, really what we ought to do, since we are the living expression advanced thinking in law, we ought to go around the world and see if we can find criminal justice systems that don't match our high standards. And therefore, we will set up a court. The court never had and does not have unanimous support of the member nations of the United Nations. They got, a quorum or something? No, better than that. They did get enough votes at the General Assembly to set it up, but its jurisdiction could not extend to those states that didn't sign up. And it has been a damn mess, frankly. And everyone, everyone is too strong a word. Many people involved in politics around the world look to the ICC as a way to achieve political ends, and because they're thinking political revenge and they're not thinking about justice, they look the other way when the system doesn't seem to work at all. But this all came to a head, well, it is coming to a head at the UN Security Council. That's bringing back to what we're going to talk about. Later in the show, I'm going to read something which I think has a lot of import. I might be mistaken. That wouldn't be the first time. This is the Taylor Report. It is CIUT 89.5 FM in Toronto. And we want to talk about this tremendous event that the whole world was watching. And for what do you know, the greatest sporting event, certainly of the year, maybe if every 4 years, seems to be a really, truly world event, the football matches. And this one was in New Jersey, and in attendance was, lo and behold, the President of the United States. And Mr. Carney was there, and the President of Mexico. It's quite remarkable, and so we're going to go into that. But probably we'll play a little music because we think it's probably totally inappropriate, but we'll play it. And then we'll come back, and Pedro and I are going to talk about what we learned watching the big match.
Thank you.
Hey, we're back. Taylor Report. Sinead O'Connor, am I right? Don't Cry For Me, Argentina. And the song of in the musical, it's the character Eva Perón. Probably a lot of people in Argentina today are thinking about Eva. They're probably thinking about Perón because they have a president who's even more colorful than Trump, which takes some doing, really hard to do. He tops him out. Apparently, by the way, he wasn't present. I think Pedro has his mic on. Are you there, Pedro?
I am, Phil.
I don't think the president of Argentina was at the game, was he?
No, he wasn't. Apparently, he has a. There's a superstitious. They're very Argentinian people, like many people, are very superstitious. And he was wearing a very. According to him, according to reports, he was wearing a very, very special coat, hidden out in his lair, praying for Argentina to come through.
Really?
Yep.
Wow, that's more. See, that's the kind of information you get from Pedro. Pedro is. You can find him at pedropaquero.com, and he practices. Up-close magic. We could probably get a few more customers. Call it intimate magic. Pedro, you actually are you're a football fan, a real one. F-U-T-B-O-L football, right?
Yeah, Phil. I love the way football, soccer makes me feel inside. I like watching the games. I'm not the most fantastic player, but to me, it's beautiful music to watch.
Did you say you play yourself? You play the game or have?
I fall down a lot.
Yeah. Oh, well, let's go. The game was surprising in many ways. I guess Argentina had what is reputedly the greatest player, and I'd ask your opinion. Do you think Messi is the greatest player at the moment?
In my generation, it's a very interesting topic, Phil. I think that, you know, within a system, within a team, within a character, within coaches, how do you respond to all these people? But absolutely, Messi has played all over the world. He's played for some wonderful teams. He's won almost every championship imaginable. So it's a very difficult argument to say he is not the greatest, but there's been so many great, fantastic soccer players, football players out there. So he's definitely one of the best.
So the... It appeared to me at the end, when I didn't see it coming, but once the game was completed, it seemed to be a case of teamwork beating a genius. That is, he has gifts, no question. But the Spanish team was so efficient that they basically kept him out of the game.
The Spanish controlled the ball the whole game, and I think that Argentina as a team, they had zero shots on goal for the first half, and Spain, every game they played in the World Cup was a beautiful thing to watch, so that's absolutely one of the best teams, I think, in World Cup history.
It's really remarkable. If I'm right, they were talking about, you know, how wonderful the Spanish goalkeeper was, and somebody said, yes, of course, he didn't have to do anything I don't remember. Did they actually have anything described as a shot on goal?
No, not in the first half, not in the first 90 minutes. But he did. The Spanish goalkeeper did challenge. He would run out and challenge players as they were coming closer. So he was out of the box, and he was a very, very aggressive goalkeeper to watch, which was fun to watch for the fans who were watching the game.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I shouldn't say unfortunately. Inevitably, people talk about politics. You can't avoid it. People say, well, who are you for? And then everybody does their calculations. And there was one that stood out, and I hope people remember it. Donald Trump has a thing about Spain. By the way, Spanish president wasn't there either, I don't think. I doubt that he could have got a visa. The way Trump has been talking about Spain recently is if you take him at his word, and of course nobody does anymore, but he's talking about 100% sanctions on Spain for opposing his so-called peace program in the Middle East, And also, Spain's reaction to the bombing of Iran by Israel and the United States, going back some months, was to send an ambassador or to open an embassy in Iran. I mean, he is treading right into the wheelhouse of crazy U.S. power and the madness of U.S. politics. So Trump really got mad. My guess is that a lot of people around the world, particularly after the bombing, just as we saw that they were sympathetic to the team, the Iranian team, that had to stay in Mexico and could only visit the United States for a certain number of hours. And then followed by the Spanish advance through the ranks, I'm sure a lot of political sympathy went to them, combined with the fact that that Argentina is morbidly obsessed and in love with Trump. So, you know, I think for the Argentine players, that was a kind of psychic disadvantage, because they had to know that people are looking at them and saying, why are you guys so tight with him? Then there's also, just to throw in a number of issues, an issue of race. Did you notice this, Pedro, that people talk about these games and they say, how many black players? And is that, for example, is Mbappe, is he really French? And the German team had a number of black players. And, tongues will wag. Whatever editorial people say in departments say, the people are watching. And they notice, they look for discriminatory conduct. They notice for whether there's some, if an incident happens between two players, people intuitively look to see how this fits into our political psyche. It's remarkable. It is a fact that Argentina doesn't. There are no black players in Argentina that I'm aware of. Do you have any contrary information?
No, Phil, I don't.
I've noticed on the internet people are looking into this. They want to know, well, how come? And fortunately, there is an answer, but it's a tragic answer. And it has to do with the whole phenomenon of slavery and how states evolved. It wasn't just the United States who has gone through this. You could make an argument, I believe, that if you had an all-African team, Africa would win every tournament. It'd simply be the case. So, what was your? Did you have a favorite in this tournament? Did you yourself? I'm talking about political biases and how it plays into this. Where did you start? When the whole thing began, of course, we're for Canada, tell me about actually, you follow it enough you can talk about the Canadian team, but what was your take on it?
Yeah, I think I would defer to the coach and all the Canadian players when they said that this has changed, I think, the future of soccer in Canada. And I'm going to keep using that word soccer. I know it's football, but here, you know, I'm in Canada, so I'm calling it soccer.
Apparently soccer comes from the British, right? They're the ones who... Soccer was the name of a sporting club or something. It is my understanding. And so the British use that term, and the Americans use it because they don't want to get confused about what football is, though they're very confused. But the rest of the world, I guess it's football.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, when I was in Europe, in England, they did call it football there. So it's, I don't know. Yeah, maybe it's a historical thing, and there's been some changes exactly. But here, you know, when I was playing as a young person, it was always soccer. What's that? And I think that's changed now. So I think a lot of Canadians are calling it football because it's been such a beautiful thing to watch, and the Canadian team was so inspiring. Estacio had that beautiful goal to win that game and put Canada into the next round. So I think that was and then the marching of the Canadian people and just the whole spectacle of it and the spirit of it. Absolutely. The Canadian team was very, very inspiring. And the coach was fantastic communicating his thoughts about how important the game was. And of course, the games in Canada, right? So having the World Cup in Canada was a great, you know, in Toronto and then on the West Coast. So I think a lot of people, it was great just to sort of, you know, to be sort of involved in that. Although, again, it, you know, to get into the stadium, there was a high price for that. But it's...
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
Yes.
But yeah, absolutely. But the Canadian team, just the whole lead up, if you see their progression, that, you know, getting better and better and better, it's a great example to watch, a great style of football to play. So the way that they play is so exciting, very aggressive. They sort of throw caution into the wind, and it doesn't matter if they're playing. I mean, they were looking forward, if they would have won that game, they would have went on to play France, and they were like, bring on France. So just the whole attitude of that. Fearlessness, kind of. It was a wonderful team to watch.
Yeah. So your favorite was Canada. You didn't, and after that, you weren't placing any bets.
It was such a, you know, a kind of cerebral thing. Like my heart and just the whole spirit was, you know, cheering for the underdog and go Canada. But I think deep down there was this space where it was like, you know, don't cheer for them, you're going to be sad or something, right? But, you know, I think that, and that's the fun thing, was that even though, you know, they perhaps weren't the, you know, the upper echelon team, that they put in the effort to do it, and that's a great example for future Canadian football soccer players.
Yeah, I hope actually that the generalized prayer hope will come to pass, actually, because something... The phenomenon of American parochialism, creating games that they play and dominate and regard it as belonging to them, which is a colonial thing. I mean, the British were shocked when they found out that the colonials and former colonies could beat them at their own game. The Americans have... Now, their major sporting event is the Super Bowl, and that sport is barely a sport. There's something wrong. If you care about your general the health of your population, you want them to be playing sports and competing, you have to say, well, look at... When it comes to football, the people playing it are not disproportionately different from everybody else. They Messi, I believe, is about 5, 6, or 7. That's it. And these players, I don't know how many of them reach 200 pounds. But if you, and it's a sport in which the players have to perform, and they don't get to call timeout and have someone in the press box, but the box for the official on a microphone talking in the ear of them to tell them what to do. American football, the play lasts 5 seconds, 5, maybe 6, 7 seconds. Then everything stops. And then into the ear of the quarterback comes the instructions. You will do this. And the players, the interior linemen, and I think it's probably no longer interior, probably they average 300 pounds. And they have what they call free substitution, or let's just say you're able to substitute any time you want. And so in the American football, they have what they call a platoon system. And so you come off the field, you play defense. And then when your team has the ball, the defense comes off the field, and then they have the guys called the offense. By the way, all of those linemen, again, are 300 pounds, every one of them. And now we're not talking about, it used to be professional football would have one or two guys who were 300. Now college teams and high school teams have 300 pound. And I hate to say this, but some families seem to be, it's like they're going to have a son who's going to be a sumo wrestler. They're looking after their diet and lifting weights. Now, I'd say, well, let's all play real football, and you have to stay out there, and you have to keep running. There wouldn't be any 300-pound players. Zero. And I think what you would have is regular size players. And you also, to give credit to the world sport of football, the responsibilities with the players, it's true they have a coach and they have, you have a game plan and he put the team together. But they're out there and they have to chase and make the right move and make the right, and it's all on them. And if they flub, they got to run down the field and you can't call timeout and you can't all go to the sideline and listen to somebody shouting at you. You're out there and you're going to have to play. And to me, that means that, okay, then we're playing a human sport. But if we're going to start manufacturing bodies to weigh 300, and they're going up now, they're headed for 400 in terms of weight, then there's something wrong with the game. Because the game should be playable by anyone in good health who has speed and hand-foot coordination in football. It would be hands, et cetera. I don't know if you know, Pedro, but it used to be a penalty in football if the coaches were caught signaling to the quarterback what to do. If they indicated throw a pass up, 15-yard penalty, because that decision's supposed to be made by the player on the field. So they got rid of that. And originally, in football, as it was played at the time of the when it first became a kind of a mania in America, Jim Thorpe is one of the great names, indigenous American, and Red Grange, people like that, they played both ways. It was still a game in which you had to be able to not just play offense, you had to play defense. And you stayed on the field. You didn't go, take a break. But they changed that. And so what we're getting is, it seems to me, we're getting a kind of a corporate thing where each skill set is isolated. And and only certain people can be there. If you don't weigh 300, you're not going to play in the line. And so that's a reality which seems to me makes a mockery of the idea, why don't we all play this and be good American Canadian boys and girls, play this game of specialization and coaching to the nth degree. We have quarterback coaches, we have running back coaches, we have defensive coordinators, we have offensive coordinators. It's kind of like a corporate problem. You say you guys are overweight. You have too many people at the top who don't actually play, but are being paid tremendous salaries to micromanage a behemoth that you've created. And that's not a sport exactly. Something gone really haywire. And it'd really be wonderful if the Americans said, oh, let's start. Just put your kid into playing F-U-T-B-O-L, football. An example might be, I'll just give you one to show that I have some people on my side in this argument. There was a great football player. You can look him up. He was what they called an immortal. Kyle Rote. What a wonderful name. K-Y-L-E, Rote, R-O-T-E. He was one of the handsomest people ever put on a uniform. Really quite a remarkable guy. And he had a wonderful career. He played both ways, offense and defense. And when his career was over, he had a young son who was just entering probably at that time high school, and he put him into a soccer program. I'm using soccer so that people, Americans, will know what we're talking about. He said, I don't want to see him banged up. I want him to be able to have to be well coordinated, to be in good health, to use his speed, develop skills. And I don't want him to see his knees destroyed the way his was. One last thing, Pedro, did you notice they had natural grass. You know about that? Apparently that's insisted upon. There can't be artificial turf in a World Cup.
No, absolutely not, Phil. There's been lots of situations before in the past where the pitch has been an issue in the games. So a lot of players, making comments about the pitches in the past. So absolutely, the pitch, just like if you're playing pool or billiards, right, you want that surface as solid as possible, as beautiful as possible. And so, yes, they put a lot of effort into making sure the pitch, the grass, is natural, in good condition. And they did a great job. I was at a game, a Toronto TFC game, it was a Canada friendly game, and there was a downpour, and they put an hour delay. There was thunder and lightning, and people were looking at their phones and looking at, okay, when's the lightning going to stop? We want to see the game. And finally the lightning stopped, and after like this big massive downpour, the game started like 10 minutes after the rain ended. It's like, how come there was no pools of water? So absolutely, the turf is so great. The things they put in to make it beautiful. I just want to make one comment you were saying before about the specialization in sports. And it's interesting, they showed a picture of Usain Bolt during one of the games. He was enjoying the game. And one of the commentators who was doing the color commentating said, well, he was really fast, but he wasn't so fast with the ball. So he tried to, he wanted to play soccer, football, but despite his incredible speed, he just didn't have the coordination with the feet. So a lot of great athletes try to play the game of football, soccer, but it is a very, tactical game. You have to know positions, where to play. There's an instinct, a feel that these great players have.
Yeah, I suppose that's also training concentration. It's a rare athlete can move from one sport to another. They basically have to focus. I've heard it said or read authoritatively that Mbappe is the fastest player by far of all the football players. Are you aware of that?
I think it's interesting when they talk about quickness, because there's this quickness off the ball. So when someone has the ball, how fast can you accelerate that first 5 meters to get by your defender?
Yeah.
And then there's these other players who can just make a beautiful timed run. It's also
I think his is the run. I mean, they've clocked him, apparently, that, as they say, is as fast as any sprinter when he's in full flight.
He's an incredible athlete, and he right now currently is probably the best player in the world.
Now,
as far as goals go, we're talking goal scoring, right?
Yeah. I thought we caught Pedro switching to greatest. What is this with him and Messi? Is it for this tournament or for all time at FIFA that he has the most goals?
Sorry, Phil, could you repeat that again?
Maybe that was a trick question. They noted that he is two goals ahead of Messi, that is Mbappe. And is that for this tournament, or is this for a time playing as a competitor in FIFA?
Total goals in the World Cup.
So in other words, they both have been in previous, and they put those goals together. So he ended up the tournament two goals ahead.
Or is it one goal? Yeah, I think it's one goal ahead. I'm not sure, but one or two goals, yep.
He's, I think he's, what is he, 27? No, he's 37. I get it. Everybody, everybody listening, of course, you understand, Pedro, they're way ahead of us. They're all
39? Are you talking about Messi?
Yeah, Messi's 39.
39.
And, by the way, you don't envy somebody as great as that having to read about himself in the paper where everybody says, well, that's it. He won't make the telling when what you do is go out on that field and you're reading people saying, well, he won't be able to do that. I remember the great Willie Mays when he played his last game and they brought him out and the crowd was all standing. And they gave him a microphone, and he said, I can't speak about this. He said, what I want to do is play the way you think of me playing, but I can't do it anymore. You know, he had to just stand there and say, what I want to do is be Willie Mays, you know. But the day had come. This is, in case you're wondering, the Taylor Report, CIUT, 89.5 FM. I think we've pretty much covered. On the grass point, I'm glad I raised it. Again, the National Football League, they leave it up to the owners of stadiums as to determine whether there'll be grass. And maybe we'll even look it up and give you the numbers. But there are a number of teams who insist on artificial turf. And if you're a 300-pound guy, I just spoke of, or you happen to be a running back in 205, and you or receiver, probably 190, 210, and you get knocked into the air and land on that turf, the hardest part was the landing because it's like, you know, falling on a rug over pavement. And it's amazing how short-sighted or corporate the thinking is that they won't go to the trouble to put grass, because I played a lot of football myself, but falling onto grass, that's different.
And as well, yeah, Phil, even, you know, horse racing as well, you know, the horses that race on the natural grass, it's a lot easier on their knees. They have a longer life, a longer racing life, that is. Yeah. Less injury. There's a lot less injuries, even in, I think it's a well-known fact if with the body. Bones, cartilage, absolutely. Natural grass, cushioning, you'll get less injuries.
Yeah. No, I think there ought to be a crusade. People claim to love sports. If you're going to play them, play on natural turf. And this, somebody found a way to save a few bucks, and they forget that's human flesh out there. Some of those guys are fairly expensive, and they're destroyed. They smash their shoulders, their knees, the other thing, of course, we all know is that artificial turf gives a funny bounce to the ball. Baseball players know that. There are some stadiums that you got to be careful. If you come in on a fly ball that would in turf on grass would go bounce, bounce, and you pick it up, but on artificial turf, it goes bounce, and it's over your head, and you have to run back to the wall and find it. Anyway, the whole sports thing has been very enlightening, I think. It gives everybody a chance to really reflect. And the New York Times today actually has a piece about this in which they say that Trump behaved, they excluded a referee. He's a certified professional referee. He wasn't allowed in the country. I think he was from Senegal, Sudan. I don't know where he was from. They wouldn't let him be a referee, because of the U.S. foreign policy designated him, whoever he's a relative of, he couldn't come in the country. Then they treated Iran shabbily. And then Trump intervened and restored the status. He had a red carded player, and he called head of FIFA and got his player reinstated. And it actually, it's called disgraceful behavior. It's tolerated, but it brings up an old word, honor. There's absolutely no honor. You know, if a guy is beaten and he knows he's beaten, but somebody says, well, we've decided that we're going to declare you the winner because in the third round a guy hits you with his thumb or something. And he says, no, I know I was beaten, so don't give me, I'm not looking for any favors. Trump actually tried the oldest things that corrupt people do. Just fix it. And I remember when he had the idea that he was going to put Italy, going to replace Iran with Italy. And in this, the nation of Italy, the state of Italy, and the players of Italy said, no, we didn't win. We don't belong there. They didn't say, oh, wow, he did us a favor, now we're going to play. No, they have self-respect. You know, it's curious that somebody who's out of his mind to tell everybody to respect him, he doesn't have any self-respect. There's no honor. The words dignity and honor seem to have gone out of the vocabulary of everyone. It's in the U.S. leadership, and I'm including Democrats, by the way. I'm not pass it around to all of them. This is the Taylor Report. We're going to take a little break. We're going to play some, I think you said Spanish music, right? Coming up. Some flamenco from Spain celebrating the fact that they're the champs. By the way, I want to mention again, that's PedroPaquero.com, Up Close Magic. Pedro has shared his views with the, and really positive ones, about Canada joining the sporting world as opposed to being part of this strange Super Bowl, supersize players, and getting back to human-sized players, regular people, playing and being healthy and learning to get to know the rest of the world. This is the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. Here is a statement from by a member of the Security Council, United Nations Security Council, on a touchy subject. And it is from Anna Evstigneva at the UNSC briefing on the ICC report on Darfur. Might sound a little remote. It is not. It's at this moment, there are people who are calling for, once again, responsibility to protect, and the Canada should jump in and do something in the case of Sudan and Darfur. And believe me, if you haven't learned from the last 10, 15 years, you really ought to get out of politics and take up another occupation. Foreign interference, and particularly coming from a NATO member at this point, would be unmitigated disaster. But here's what the statement says. Mr. President, 21 years ago, the Security Council adopted resolution 1593, referring the situation in Darfur to the International Criminal Court, ICC. However, throughout all that time, the court has failed to fulfill the mandate entrusted to it. The latest report by the so-called Office of the Prosecutor only attests to the ICC's systemic inability to deliver justice for the victims of the Darfur conflict. Over two decades of work on this file, the ICC has brought in only one guilty verdict against a single defendant. Even that proceeding, however, is still pending and is currently at the appeals stage. The obsessive touting of the ICC's purported achievements in this context is at the very least perplexing. We see no value in wasting the Security Council's time on hearing briefings composed of excuses and promises from an institution that has long since ceased to have anything to do with genuine justice and is only making a negative contribution to achieving lasting reconciliation. Mr. President, what is particularly alarming today are the consistent attempts by the ICC to expand its jurisdiction beyond the mandate which was granted to it by the Security Council in 2005. We would like to recall that Resolution 1593 provided for the referral to the court of a very specific situation in Darfur, as it was in 2002. No new tasks regarding Sudan were entrusted to the ICC. We're not going to stand idly by as the ICC, having failed in its original mandate, arbitrarily intervenes in events taking place 20 years later, obstructing the achievement of a long-awaited sustainable peace in Sudan. The reasons behind the ICC's initial failure are obvious and well-known. In pursuit of short-term gains, the court egregiously trampled upon universally recognized principles and norms concerning the immunities of high-ranking officials, as well as the sovereign equality of states. The ICC attempted to coerce the states of the region into grossly violating international law when demanding that they arrest and surrender a sitting head of a sovereign state that was not a party to the ICC Rome Statute. It is telling that not a single African state succumbed to the pressure of the pseudo-court and agreed to comply with these illegal demands. Mr. President, the deep-rooted crisis of the ICC extends far beyond its glaring inefficiency and politicization. This body has incessantly been at the heart of a whole host of scandals. One such scandal involves a recently suspended, but still formally incumbent, ICC prosecutor, Karim Khan, UK national, who has been accused of sexual harassment. We found revealing the exposés published recently in the Times, June 27, and the New York Times, July 8. They contained highly unflattering details that vividly illustrate not only the story of Mr. Khan, but also the deeply dubious practices and atmosphere within the ICC as a whole. The situation surrounding the prosecutor has become a litmus test, clearly exposing the existing shortcomings in terms of transparency, accountability, and the fight against impunity within the ICC, which some countries continue to portray as an embodiment of international justice. Thus, this pseudo-court has repeatedly rewritten its own internal procedures, tailoring them to the case of Mr. Khan. It has employed various tools, from increasing the level of secrecy surrounding investigations into its own officials and preventing disclosure of any related information, to amending the voting procedures having to do with the suspending of the incumbent prosecutor. Instead of a previous two-stage procedure, which envisaged two separate votes on the fact of misconduct and on the suspension, there will now be a single-stage vote. It is obvious that the truth is needed, not to expedite the process of establishing the truth and holding the guilty parties accountable, but rather to swiftly sweep this scandalous story under the rug. The court has proved incapable of ensuring compliance with the rules, even within its own ranks. The ICC is rewriting the rules on the fly just to promptly get rid of a toxic senior official. Turn the page on this uncomfortable chapter and pretend that nothing ever happened. We are perplexed by the fact that the sanctions under consideration appear to be limited to only disciplinary action and suspension from office. In any self-respecting state governed by the rule of law, the actions attributed to Mr. Khan would entail not merely dismissal, but criminal prosecution and a lengthy prison sentence. As we have learned, there is a separate case having to do with Mr. Khan intimidating the victim and other staff members to cover up his misconduct. But this case will not be considered at all by the Assembly of States parties to the Rome Statute. Apparently, such practices are deemed acceptable within the ICC. The case of Mr. Khan is not an isolated incident, but merely the tip of the iceberg. It is evident that the ICC is incapable of putting its own house in order. The time has long since ripe for a more thorough investigation into all corruption and ethics violations within this body, which has turned into a tool for political control by the collective West and is being used to exert pressure on inconvenient states. While the ICC imitates vigorous activity and seeks to salvage what remains of its tarnished reputation, the actual situation in Sudan continues to deteriorate. The unprecedented humanitarian crisis, the escalation of violence, the destruction of Al-Fashir, and the situation in El Bayad clearly demonstrate that the ICC is fundamentally incapable of making any meaningful contribution either to the administration or justice of justice or national reconciliation. Once again, we call on our colleagues on the council to reconsider withdrawing both the Darfur and Libya files from the ICC. Issues of accountability for serious crimes should be addressed by the Sudanese people themselves through national proceedings, which have proved to be far more effective as they take into account the country's specific circumstances and the will of its people. The international community should support the Sudanese in the process, with the African Union playing an active role therein, given its unique capacities for mediation and dialogue. The Security Council should focus on identifying and employing real rather than illusory mechanisms to resolve the problem. We set out our position on the Sudanese settlement in detail at the end of, June. Lasting peace in Sudan cannot be achieved through externally imposed solutions, nor through mock justice delivered by a politicized pro-Western body. There is a need to create conditions for a genuine, inclusive, inter-Sudanese dialogue that reflects the interests of all segments of the population and all political forces of the country. And the Hague pseudo-court is nothing but an obvious obstacle to such a dialogue. This is the Taylor Report, CIUT. I think we have 1 minute to go. Wow, we're getting it done. I'll just say I really agree with that proposition. At the United Nations Security Council, the ICC is not the road to solve any problem for any of you who have fallen for that. Don't look for revenge. Look for justice. Pedro, thank you very much. And and Steve Fruitman is going to be coming up here, 33, 45, 78. Great show. See you next week.